I guess so. I'm not Rafaela, of course, but so far there's no reason for not publishing them. I don't know when she plans to do so, so I can't really tell, but in principle they should be, I guess.
So, welcome everyone. My name is Michael Petter. I for today and the next weeks until there's something unplanned maybe, the lecturer for this lecture. Rafaela, you can meet in the tutorial again if you desire so. So, she told me that she stopped with last time's slides directly after the construction of the non-deterministic automaton from the regular expressions with the sophisticated Berry-Sethi algorithm version. So what you have seen as result of the algorithm for the example last time was the automaton right over here. Yes, please. Okay. Well, the mic is on, but I'm not so sure whether it's actually really connected. There seems to be some kind of interference with the speakers, it seems. So maybe it's not loud enough.
Is that better now?
That there's the wrong frequency set up here, so but I have to check that afterwards. I can't do that right now, so I guess I'll have to speak up then. Okay, so the result that you have had last time from the Berry-Sethi approach was the automaton that you have on this particular slide over here, which already seems quite nice. It has a few nice properties, like the number of states that you will find in that resulting automaton is actually bounded by the number of terminal symbols that are used in the original regular expression, plus the arbitrary starting point that we introduced the whole thing. So this is already a nice property. But the automaton that you see over here is still quite a complicated one, and even more, you'll see that the automaton also has nice features like outgoing edges that carry the same label, originating from the same state, which is always a bothersome thing to implement for certain implementations, like these table-driven state implementations. So that is a thing that doesn't look particularly nice to implement. So one thing that we can do in order to turn that more or nicer to deal with is to turn the automaton deterministic. And you may recall a way to do so from your theoretical computer science. Anything that comes to mind for that?
Okay.
So, power set construction is the keyword here, and indeed that is what we're going to see there. Of course, there's also other ideas what you can do to not come up with such a ugly automaton in the first place. Particularly, there's ways to try to get rid of a lot of redundancy in this automaton by initially already go different way than the Berry-Sethi approach, which would be, for example, this Anti-Mirov construction or some algorithms for constructing follow automata. These are things that are a little bit more complicated than the version that we have seen on the slides, so we will skip that in lecture. However, there's room for presenting these algorithms in the mini-talks in the end of the semester. So if you're interested in those, in these automata constructions, then feel free to join in with these. So, for our purposes, Berezethi is enough. It's also quite handy to use for implementation, since we, in the typical compiler setup, we already have the syntax tree of input thing like the regular expression already present, and the Berezethi thing is a thing which just runs as a few depth first search on the syntax tree anyway, so it's a rather straightforward approach to implement. Anyway, we still need a deterministic version, and that's where the power set construction comes into the play that you already mentioned. So I don't know how many really recall how to do that, so let's have a quick recap on that. So in our example, the input for the power set construction would be the original automaton, and the idea is now to try to trace the possible path that you can take starting from the input of the automaton, and try to track what states you can reach within a single step, combine them into a collecting state, which is a subset of the whole set of states, thus this power set construction thing, and then track wherever you can go via particular input symbols from this collective state, reaching another collective state, and so on. And since this sounds quite complicated, let's have a look at how that works in practice. So we start always with an initial state, which corresponds to the original initial state over here. If we have automata with several starting states, we already introduce the first collecting state, which is associated with all the others. So in our case, well, it doesn't carry a name, so I didn't put a name in there, but this is already potentially a set of original states. So this one is the start one. How to proceed from there is now to pick a particular label in order to track what we can, what states we can reach in the original automaton. So let's do so. We have, for example, the A over here. So let's track what we can do with transition going A from our start state, and we will for sure reach some state at least, so we can already do the bubble. And what goes into the bubble is all the states that we can reach in the original automaton. So that is, for our purposes, the 0 and the 2, of course. Is there anything else? No, there's just another edge, which is B. And since we already look at that, we can also create that transition, which goes from here with B to another state, which is, for our purposes, just 1 and nothing else. In the original power set construction, you would have to also pay attention to the epsilon transitions that you could potentially have. Our construction doesn't have to, since the Berezethi automaton doesn't create any epsilon transitions, so we're on the safe side here. Anyway, that is the first step that we did. Now we have to pick one of the newly generated states and try to explore what we can reach via transitions based on the original automaton. So let's have a look at the state over here. So this corresponds to state 0 and state 2 in the original automaton. So let's enumerate all the possible terminals in our terminal space, and what we get is, of course, there's A and B that we can go. So with A, we can reach 0 itself. So this goes to something containing 0 and 2. So potentially 0 and 2. Anything else? No. Three? Can we reach three from two? Well, that is the next thing. Going, yeah, exactly. So we take the other one also, because that is also in the power set. And this means that we also have to consider this one. So 3 is the next one to integrate. So this also goes into this list of original states that were reachable under this input. And yeah, with that we're done. We don't have anything else to capture. So we put the state bubble around. So then there's still the B to explore. So with B emanating from 0, we can go, well, this one, of course. This goes to 1. Anything else? 0 is done, so we go over to state 2 and see that via B we can reach 4. So this goes to 1, 4. Okay. So that's this state over here explored. Then let's have a look at this one. This is the old one state, so this is already pretty makes it pretty easy for us to track. So in the old one state goes to the state that contains 0 and 2, following these two. Yeah, and there's no other state in this collection of states in the power set automaton. So we're done with that. And I didn't put in a new bubble on there because I already knew states 0 and 2, or the combination of these two states, we already find over here. We have already created that thing. So all we do is we create the edge with the label A going to the state that we have already put in there. So now all what that remains to do is, of course, list check all the possible terminals, and B remains, so this goes back to 1, so we need to put that also on here. Okay, so with that, I think, did I know? I think that should have been everything, and we continue to do so for all of the newly generated states. So this one and this one, and I spare you to do that online now. Instead, we can have a look at what the construction does here. So, well, there's this I think is already the complete automaton. Yes. So this is all the possibilities explored. One thing maybe that is of note is the question of what is the final state in the power set automaton. And you see there are already a few states marked as being final states in the power set automaton, like this one and this one. So, I don't know. Why are they final?
Because they have the final states. They have the final states in the nodes from the original
one. Yes. So how has how's the property, if you look at it in detail, is it a for all or there exists one? So, okay, so that is the point. So it suffices that one of the states that have been collected in this state had been a final state in the original automaton, because that means that in the non-deterministic automaton, one path that you could take with that particular input would reach a final state. That is the terminating condition for the non-deterministic automaton. And if you transfer that to the deterministic one, this translates into there exists one state in the collected states that that is final. So for our purposes, state 3 and state 4, if you find any of those in a collective state, in the power set automaton, then you know that this state is final. Okay? Good. So that should have been already known from theoretical computer science. So with that, we get an actual algorithm to compute a deterministic automaton out of a non-deterministic automaton. Well, at least in theory. So the construction, we have had that informally on the slide before. How does it work? Well, the actual data type of the states that you see in there is, well, the power sets of Q. So each of the states is a subset of the possible combinations of states of the original one. So that is your domain for the states. What is the start state? Well, the start state is exactly the set of initial states from the original automaton. That is something that we also have talked about already. What are the final states? The conditions for final states is each of the combinations of states from the original automaton which intersecting with the final states from the original automaton gives a non-empty set. So if there is a final state from the original automaton found in a state of the power set automaton, it is considered a final state. And what is the actual computation of the state space for the power set construction? Well, we can just construct transitions starting from the start state, and we go, or we follow the transitions of all the possible terminals, and the outcome of that is a collecting state that consists of all small q such that the small q was reachable via transitioning under the terminal that we have mentioned in the beginning in the original automaton. Okay? Good. So, that in theory is the power set construction. This looks quite nice in terms of, well, it's small, a very concise algorithm and easy to understand. However, combining states from a set means that, well, if you try to get an overview on how much or how large the automaton can get, you need to look at the possible combinations of states that you can build from the original automaton, and it turns out that this is an exponential difference between them. So the there are exponentially many power sets of Q. And, well, exponential things are always bad. You, if you have an exponential algorithm, usually you don't consider that as a practical algorithm. Bugger. We thought we were saved for a moment here with our power set construction, but is it really? Well, let's have a look. So what we have already implicitly done in on the a few slides ago was we didn't really set up all the combinations of states from the original automaton, if you remember what we did. We instead already followed intuitively a particular strategy in order to uncover the algorithm that we would need. Because implicitly we wouldn't care about the paths that we could not go in the original automaton anyway. So a few of the states or combinations of original states wouldn't even be uncovered while doing the construction. And the base idea behind that is to not consider general power set, but only considering the so-called contributing power sets. So what we would do is we would start from a well-known spot which we know is already contributing to our power set automaton, which is this initial state collection, and only add further states by need, with by need being defined as what we can possibly reach by going transitions of terminals. So that would only uncover those states that are actually really reachable from the initial state. And that is already quite nice. That takes away a lot of the possibilities. You've seen that in our example, we could even diminish the number of states to a smaller number than before. However, this still is not enough to, at least in theory, reduce the number of sets that you could uncover enough so that it is it goes away from exponential complexity. So, well, what else is there to do? Well, you've seen me stutter a little bit when we were at this concept of generating states by need. So what is done in practice in systems that actually do search for patterns based on regular expressions, like the grab tool, for example, or any other at least somewhat sophisticated text editor, will not do the complete construction of a deterministic automaton from a non-deterministic one in all cases. Instead, what is out there as an idea is to create not the complete automaton up front, but instead just create those states that are actually needed for the particular input that you are treating at the moment. Why is that a good idea? Well, the thing is that you know that by uncovering one state in the power set construction, you introduce only one transition and one new state anyway. And since you have to process the input at least once anyway, you have at least as much, or you need at least as much computation as the input on which you search for a regular expression is long anyway. So if you just, in the worst case, have to uncover a new state for each of the input symbols, you're still only investing a kind of constant, well, not constant, but bounded the number of states in the original? Well, you only have to uncover one state at least anyway for one step in the input. And with that, you might even end up in situations where you can reuse already computed fractions of the so far uncovered automaton. So this is a thing that is actually quite impressive. So let's have a look at what this does in an example. So again, we have the automaton example from the Berezethi construction from a few slides ago. This time we try the power set construction, but now not a generic one, but the one that is valid for a particular input, particularly this ABAB thing. So how do we do that now? Now we don't arbitrarily choose the terminal for which to explore the power set space, but instead we are guided through this uncovering process by the actual input that we have to search for a particular pattern. And let's do that. This means that we first have to uncover A, which will lead us to the first step in the power set construction. So far nothing has changed. This is something that we have already done last time. But now we won't continue to uncover reachable states for the initial state, but instead we will continue with the state that we are actually in right now. So this is this one. And we also won't uncover everything from there, but just the things reachable by going B. And with that we will uncover this transition leading to the state over there. And well, we continue to do so based on the next input and the last set that we have seen. So this goes A from 1-4, which will reach this one again, uncovering the edge A, and then we go B, and that is something that we have already done so far, so there's no new state uncovered. Instead, we can reuse what we already have and reach this part over here. So you see, compared to what we have done before, there would still be potential for uncovering, but we didn't need that for that particular input anyway. In case that the in case that we would want to search for that particular regular expression in another input, we could, for example, now conserve the fraction of the automaton that we have uncovered and reuse it next time when we are again searching for that particular pattern. And this would enable us to take profit from the already explored part of the automaton and only adding those bits that we need for the new input pattern, so for new input text. So this could even save us more, so we can cache the uncovered fractions of the power set automaton in that sense. So that is what we can do in order to not be overwhelmed by this exponential algorithm and come to a practical implementation of that. So, yeah. All in all, what we can say is that for regular expressions, we can now compute the deterministic automaton such that the language that the automaton accepts is the language for the regular expression. Now to a little bit more practical motivated parts of the scanner design, now that we have the fundamentals for coming up with a practical algorithm for the matching of regular expressions in inputs, is what do we need now to assemble an actual scanner for our first component in the actual compiler. So what we usually set up as the input for a complete compiler is that we specify all the possible token classes of our of our language in form of regular expressions in rules. So there's regular expressions E1 to EK, all of them specifying a particular pattern of input that makes up a token class. And in the context of a scanner, we usually get the chance to also specify in callback routine whatever action we want to take when the input matches a particular token class. So usually the scanner then runs on a particular input in an more or less endless loop, trying to match the token classes that we've specified over here. And each time that a particular token class is matched, a callback for the where action 1 to action k is connected to is then triggered. So in terms of making it more precise, what this list of rules does is that the scanner is implemented that way, that it tries to, first of all, read in a maximum number of characters from the input such that still one of the patterns for the tokens is matching. So, if, for example, the pattern EK and the pattern E1 overlap somewhat, for example, E1 specifies AB and EK specifies ABCDE, then the scanner would try to maximize the number of characters that are taken from the input, and thus it would match with the token class EK and then trigger the callback for EK. In case that this maximum match has been done and several rules apply, for example, because the pattern from E2 and the pattern from E4, both of them match, then what takes precedence is the actual position within the list. So the pattern that comes first is also served first. So in case that a particular pattern matches, or two pattern matches, the one with the lower index is the one whose action is then triggered in the callback phase. So for that means that for our scanner, we need to first of all construct maximum maximum matches, and then dispatch to minimal indices. Okay? So, in order to do so, what you can do as well, you already have you can just do the construction for the automaton that reads the expression from over here, where you match either E1 to EK, and then take special care of how to interpret the actual final state in which you end up being in by defining the final states in kind of a hierarchy. So you get you give the final states kind of markers, which of the original regular expressions has has contributed to this one, and if there are several, then you assign the minimal number of automata that contributed to that to this particular final state. In practice, that looks like this. You put these names F1 to FK to each of the final states, where F1 would mean that this is associated with the final state matching for the first regular expression. FK would mean that it would match with the kth regular expression. And they are determined in the way that you take the general or some state from the general final states, and the ones that have a final state from the E1, which you can just query by this property last of E1, which you should already have been computing, then this is considered to be a member of F1. And for the state F2, you take all the states except the ones that you have already marked in the step before, and check whether there is those come from the last states of E2. Then you consider them to be of you consider them to be associated with the automaton 2, and so on until you finally reach the last states for the kth automaton. So with that, you have then marked all the final states with the number that tells you which regular expression they came from. So with that, you can usually dispatch to the minimum index with respect to the order in which those expressions have appeared in the scanner specification. All that remains now is to find a way to actually do this this maximum match. And that is a thing which is kind of, poor man's backtracking, so to say. So the idea is to manage two pointers that go through the input together with a structure of two states of the deterministic automaton for the scanner, and the those two pointers as well as those two elements of the struct would serve for this kind of one-step backtrack, in the sense that the first component would go through the automaton and try to reach states in the automaton until it cannot reach anything anymore, and the according cell in this tuple for the states would keep track of what the current state is, and each time that you go a step, you whenever you reach a final state, you would keep track of that the position where you have met a final state in your automaton in this pointer B, as well as track which final state this has been in the second component of your struct, and continue on working. So with that, you get the last match that was matching a final state in your second component, and can still explore whatever you can reach with your input until you reach some point where you cannot reach anything valid anymore, and at that point you go back to your last valid match of a final state and take that as the longest match. Let's have a look at an example what that does. So that is our example input over here, and our two fields in which we keep track of the particular positions and states. So somewhere in the middle we start with a typical initialization of these things, like the state which we are in is Q0 right now, and there the last state that we have tried to save, where we had a valid final state, is at that point not valid, so it's bottom here. So let's go through this thing. It seems that in this, conceptually I've mixed up A and B with each other, so A is the one that saves and B is the one that goes through the input. So, but anyway, the concept is the same. So the both pointers point to the start where we start the algorithm, and now we go through the whole thing with this B thing until, well, for example, let's take this snapshot over here where we have progressed so far. Both both pointers point to N right now. So far, this all this has been one identifier, which would be, well, an identifier could be stopped anywhere, but in particular, it can also be stopped right here. So it goes over here with Q4 being a final state in our thing. So let's have a look at what happens when we go one more. We see that in the underlying automaton, we would have to go a transition under the input of white space thing, which we find in here. But happens that the automaton that we have constructed for that thing doesn't have any input pattern that features a sequence of characters followed by white space. And this would mean that there would be no automaton that has this transition as a valid transition from one state to another. So this would fail that particular transition. In that case, what we do is we would go back to the last point where we actually have a valid state, which is this one, which means that this was the last valid position, with Q4 being the state with which this thing is associated, which means that this thing here will be considered as an actual token belonging to the token class that is given by this Q4 thing. So usually what then happens is this is cut away from the input and put into some representation object for a particular token, classified with the token that belongs to Q4, given to the next phase in the compiler, and the algorithm restarts with initial values for those positions of the input and would start reading whatever is possible to go from the initial state, thus continue the whole thing with, well, usually in this case it would match a white space thing, would chop that away from the input, give that either as a token to the next phase or even sort it out if there's no valid token for white space, and then continue with this thing, and whatever. So this is the way that the whole thing would actually work. So apart from the longest match, what else is there in concrete scanners? Well, so far we have just seen the part that takes a regular expression, makes it converts that into an automaton and then runs without interference of the user. However, there's also a concept that that helps scanner definition writers in cases where they get very complicated regular expressions. For example, if you are in need of a regular expression for comments, for example, or for strings, you would have a hard time of trying to set up your expression such that you would exactly match the end of your comment again or your input and deal with all these escaping characters in between and all these complicated ways of putting things into strings such that they don't match with any other possible token class of your language. And for these types of token classes, there was an idea to make it more simple by actually really giving you access to the underlying states of your automaton and use them in a way that you say, well, instead of matching a whole string all in one, what I usually do is I match for the beginning designator for a string, like those ticks, and then whenever I've seen those ticks, I say manually go over to a particular different state, and from there from this state on, use a different set of regular expressions. You could, for example, in this one, only specify regular expressions for matching the end of the string as well as everything else. This would make your life quite easy since you just have to specify those parts of the thing. And in the part where you have matched the ending delimiter of the string, you could say, now jump back to my original set of states, to my original automaton. So this is kind of the conceptual idea behind that. This introduces the concept of so-called scanner states. And this would, in that sense, just open up a completely new automaton for this subset of rules that is only valid in that particular state. And after this is constructed, you can just manually implement the transitions from your old automaton to the new one and back again, depending on how this is specified. How you specify this in your input looks like this. So instead of just plain groups of regular expressions and according actions, as we had before, we now introduce these these curly brackets to introduce groups of rules and give them a name, so you can actually refer to them within your actions. And the actions have a particularly well-known name, which you can use in order to initiate a state transition. So, for example, when you match with this E1 thing, you could initiate a switch of automaton by by mentioning that you would like to switch to state 1, which would then transition to another one of these blocks. Well, there's text right now here, but you can imagine there are several of these blocks that you can introduce. You can switch between them via these things. There's never a YY end. Instead, it's always YY begin and a name for that thing. It's a historical thing, started a few decades ago, so nobody has ever bothered to change that, so that's why it's YY begin and nothing corresponding to that. So, but in principle, that is the way that you do that. And for the example of the of a comment, you could have not like this. You could have the a rule set for your regular language or for your normal language. Of course, there would be a lot more rules for full-fledged language, and this would be the rule set YY initial. That's the standard name in all those flex-based scanners. And for example, if you want to have one of these state-based implementations of regular expression, like the ones for the comment here, you would just look out for the regular expression for that particular construct, like this slash star here, and tell the system to turn to the automaton in state comment. This would continue to read from the input based on this thing, which would keep track of whether there is a closing token or anything else. Anything else would just be discarded, and in case of the closing token, we would switch back to the initial thing, which would then continue with matching with the rule set from before. So, yes, please.
If you don't have a YY end function, then how would you be able to have a comment in the middle of a line or somewhere else? So, to be which state you were in before entering the comment, so how would you be able to revert to
The thing with the scanner is that it's actually this state thing is maybe a little bit misleading. The scanner itself is, in that sense, stateless.
So it's not possible to have a stack of different states?
No. So there's no bracket constructions that you can do. So the states are yeah, it's really a misleading name if you think about that. So it's just kind of groups of rules. You can switch from one to another, and this state thingy that they call like that is just that now is a new set of states valid, and there's nothing stored like a stack or something. And these stack-like constructs are rather a thing of the next phase syntactic analysis anyway, so...
But that's exactly what I meant, that the state here is not the same state as when you're actually evaluating the grammar of the language.
Yeah, so
it's a sequence of tokens.
Yeah, so it's you have a hard time trying to recognize any grammar based things in with these mechanics. So yeah, there's no YY end, no bracketing things, no counting things, no stacking things. It's just different rule sets are applied now. That's kind of the semantics of that thing. So that's maybe why this YY begin is somewhat misleading, also the name of state. Interestingly, there's a lot of these kind of misuses or misunderstandings of particular names in this area of languages and compilers. So this is not the only spot which is actually really misleading. So, yeah, but I can understand why you were tempted to think of that. Okay. So, yeah. Anyway, this is kind of a practical helper for you if you try to write your own scanners in that sense. So, well, a few practical things that you have, might have seen on the slides before. I just go roughly through them. If you start using these scanner generators, you of course have the official documentations for each of those, and they are much more complete than everything that I can present here. Maybe a few things for you to help is this thing here, this dot, is usually used for matching anything, so it's a match all operator in that sense. It matches anything apart from line feed. So if you've seen that in there at some point, I think this one over here, so that's why it's here. What we already have established is that for each of the states we have a different scanner, and we manually connect them with transitions that are triggered with this YY begin thing. Also, we said that you could, in principle, also implement the things that you can express with these different scanner automata and transitions between them by just using very complex regular expressions. But, who really wants to develop a monster of a regular expression when he can have something as similar as the solution we've seen there? So, yeah. I think that's that. Is there still a question on these scanner-related topics before we move on to the next thing? No. So let's maybe have a look at the syntactic analysis part of the whole thing. So far we've had the lexical analysis, which would consist in these specifications of regular expressions for token classes and nothing more. So you've already seen that it seems to be desirable to have more advanced features in the whole thing. For example, being able to understand a little bit more about the structure of the things that we are consuming from the input files, and that's what the syntactic analysis is actually for. So this is a component of the compiler that directly docks to the scanner and takes as input what is produced by the scanner, which is a stream of tokens together with their classification, does something, and the outcome of the whole thing is, at least conceptually, a tree structure. In practice, you will, with the mechanics that we see over here, usually not directly obtain a syntax tree, but in general, you will get callbacks again, as in the case for the scanner, and the callbacks are usually triggered in a way such that you can easily create a syntax tree with whatever means your language has. There's a few parser generators out there that already try to create a syntax tree out of whatever information they have, but many of the well-known ones don't do so automatically, but just give you callbacks in which you can then call the constructors for your syntax tree representation objects yourself. So that is kind of the practical issues of all that. In principle, you still get an understanding of the syntax of your input in terms of a tree structure that tells you about what structures you find in your input. So what would be syntactic units of your of this particular analysis phase? This would be children of a particular node in the syntax tree that are on the same level, and they can be combinated into their root node as syntactic units that are called as this particular type of subtree is called. In practical languages, what you might find, what a syntactic unit would be, is, for example, an expression. What is characteristic for an expression? An expression usually has a particular value that you that can be evaluated in a pass on that particular tree, given a particular assignment of variables. What you also have as possible syntax elements are different statements. Statements usually occur in sequences and can be named like block names, or can be even used as things like procedures, which themselves are also syntactic units or functions or methods or whatever you have in your language. Statements range from expression statements that consist in evaluating or an evaluation run of that particular expression, or might be statements that fiddle with the control flow in your algorithm, like the conditional branches for loops or whatever. All these things that you have heard before when learning a program language are usually also somewhat represented in the syntactical structure of your input, and have direct representations in the syntax tree of a particular input file. So, for our purposes, we want to have a component that actually does this transformation from a token stream into such a syntactic syntax tree, since at some point we probably want to actually really translate this input file into some meaningful code. For those of you who also attend the virtual machines lecture, you have already seen the point on which the code generation schemes access the compiler, which is actually this tree structure that comes out of this parsing phase. So, as a concept for these parsers, you could, same as before with the scanner, you could of course manually just code a piece of or a module for your compiler that does the parsing. Has anyone in here already tried to actually write a concrete parser for anything? So eight people from out of roughly 30, 40, something. Okay, that's at least a little bit. I forgot to put up my hand myself. So how were your impressions in writing such a piece of software? Was that enjoyable? Did you like that? You really have fun in setting up these these string matching things. Somewhat, yeah. Well, if you do a lot of compilers and again have to set up a new parser for a new language, maybe the first one is quite a challenge and you like that, and you write the second one and so, oh well, okay, once again this thing. And with the third and fourth and fifth one that you write, you at one point can't stand that anymore. This is a very repetitive task, and as soon as you have solved the few problems that are in there, you probably are pretty bored writing a new one. It's just a lot of handwriting involved in there, except for a few mean parts of the specification of certain languages that the language authors have put as surprises in the specification. But anyway, it's quite a repetitive task, and it's, at least with a lot of the high-level languages out there, it's still quite verbose to write, and can be quite tricky in the sense that you can easily make mistakes in whatever you implement for that. So, for repetitive tasks that always solve the same problems, we have already seen for the last part of the lecture what you usually desire is to specify on a more abstract level, where you really only specify the things that really change for your component, and automate the rest of the process, for example, by generating the software component that you that we have specified in a very abstract level before, such that that does all the bothersome repetitive work for you, and you can just sit back and enjoy the show. So that is also the way that I want to show you in the next, well, actually not a few, but quite a lot slides. So specification, generator, and parser. What would you usually use for structural understanding of software components? Well, you've seen that for the scanner part, we had a specification language, the regular expressions, and as a suitable implementation of all that, there was the finite automata. So if you go a step further, a step more expressive, more abstract, we will usually end up with one level of expressivity higher than before, which would be using context-free grammars to specify how the rules actually look like, how the structure of our language looks like, and the possible implementation, what could be generated out of the specification of our hierarchical structure, would be a pushdown automaton, together with, well, a little bit of addendum in order to deal with the specialities of that domain. And pushdown automata are a thing, well, stack as a data structure is quite well known, and apart from that, it's just reading and going transitions. That seems easy enough to implement or to come up with an implementation for that. So that is what we are trying to do here. Now, in order to have the same foundations throughout the next slides, let's maybe recap a little bit about what we are going to use in the next chapters. So there's context-free grammars. I don't know whether you still remember. Is there anyone in here who didn't have theoretical or introduction to theoretical computer science so far? No? Oh, well, that's nice. So then you it's going to be easy-peasy for you. Now, context-free grammars. A short disclaimer beforehand. Usually in these theoretical computer science things, you talk about these terminals and non-terminals when you talk about these formulating these grammars. And tokens are usually associated with input alphabet, so it's usually the smallest things that your grammar talks about. So it's usually considered to be a symbol or something like that. Here, that's not the case. For actually grouping symbols into larger units of meaning, we already had one phase before, which chopped up our input into tokens and classified them already with a particular class. And these tokens are now the smallest units of meaning which we deal with in these context-free grammars. So instead of an alphabet of just symbols, the alphabet for the context-free grammars in our context are the token classes. So whenever we define grammar rules in our context-free grammars, we define them based on token classes as terminals and not actual symbols. That is something that you have to keep in mind. If you directly come from theoretical computer science, we will rather talk about token classes than actual real symbols. So the token classes make up our alphabet of terminals T, and the grammars are then a particular collection of things that you might recall that also from the theory course. The context-free grammar has a few things that it needs in order to be a meaningful definition. So we had the terminals in our context, that's token classes. Then in order to set up rules how structures in our languages actually look like, we also need names for nodes that can be unfolded into the actual structure, and they are given as the non-terminals. So this is, for example, what we call statement or an expression or something. These are names from the non-terminals, and we use them in order to set up rules that we see as the things that actually generate the structure for the input. And if you just have terminals, non-terminals, and rules, this still doesn't sufficiently specify what is actually really what we actually really mean with that particular specification until we specify what we consider to be a start symbol or a valid root node for valid syntax trees. So these are the things that we need for a context-free grammar, for a rule set that spans syntax trees for us. Okay? Good. Yeah, so how do these things look like when we deal with them? So the typical structure of these things looks like this, where you have a left-hand side that consists usually of a symbol from the non-terminals, so that's a name for a syntactic construct, and a right-hand side, alpha, which is usually a sequence of symbols taken either from the non-terminals or terminals, so that's a combination of names of syntactical components intermixed with maybe a few token classes. So that's how you specify your rules, and the operator there is the becomes thing, so becomes relation. For an example, let's have this one over here. We have one non-terminal S and the terminals AB. And this is a thing that has two rules. S can become either token class A, again S, and token class B, or it can just disappear. That's this little blue epsilon over here, which is kind of a meta character, and this stands for the empty sequence, and this means that we can replace S with just nothing. So what can we express with that? Well, there's no other choice than starting with S here, and we can either already match with the empty string. So empty string, for example, is expressible with this. And we can express A and empty string B, for example, which would fold to AB. We can have AABB, AABBB, and everything that has as many A's as B's. So this is in terms of, of semantics of what we have written here, which is also what specified language means. This is the meaning of what we have written here, and meaning is expressed as an enumeration of all the words that can be generated with this rule set. So, a list or an enumeration of all the possible strings just taken from the terminal symbols is, in that sense, the semantics of the context-free grammars. You have already implicitly seen me using a few conventions for context-free languages on these slides. So there's the non-terminals that are either written as uppercase letters, like in green, like this A, B, and C, or if we have more practical examples, you might see me using real names for the syntactic rules, like exp for the expressions, statements, stnt, and all that. All those with these funny brackets there. Terminals, by convention, we use as lowercase letters in blue, like this ABC, or in case of more concrete examples, also lowercase blue in this without the, these funny brackets. So, in a practical example, how a real grammar might look like, of, we have an excerpt for C-like, very small language. So, this is a language for mainly for statements. So, whatever is used in there will become STMT, which is, for my purposes, a statement. This can be either consist in the something unfolded from the rule if, from the rule while, or from the rule rexp, followed by the semicolon. So let's have a look at how something like the if, for example, looks like. So let's look at the rule if. And this looks like the following. We have keyword if, that's a terminal symbol, so it doesn't unfold any further. There's a left bracket and a right bracket. Both of them are enclosing one of these mysterious rexp things. But more concrete, what it also carries with it is a syntactic element of type statement. Carries two of them, one to the left of the else, one to the right of the else, depending on whichever, however the condition from over here evaluated. And whatever you can put in there is another statement. Then what else can you consider to be a statement? That is something that you find given here. This is while. So let's have a look at what while looks like. Well, again, keyword while. There's brackets that surround one of these rexp things. And since we have now seen a few of these constructs right now, what we usually see at these positions are kind of for example, conditional expressions or something like that. So the conditional expression might be something where this rexp is going. And after this while, there's room for another statement rule, and this is usually then another statement that can follow this while thing. What is a rexp thing? Well, this can be either a terminal of int. And here now, please don't make the mistake and consider this int as now being the letters int. What we are talking about here is a token class. So this is the token for an integer constant. It's not int, it's the integer constant. Then we can have, for example, LEXP, or LEXP is assigned by the REXP, or whatever comes in there. People who have had the virtual machines lecture already might now remember a little bit how the expression hierarchy looks like in the, or the expression structure looks like for the C language. And yeah, these R expressions are a little bit like the right-hand side evaluation things in the virtual machines. So yeah, that is what it's all about. It's right-hand side expressions that you see in this grammar, and there's also room for left-hand side expressions, which is this LEXP, which will, for example, become a name in the language, like a variable name or something like that. So that's just an excerpt of what you can do with these context-sensitive grammars, context-free grammars, sorry. And yeah, you could continue this example until you at some point reach kind of a usable grammar. And, well, you can even look up grammars for languages that you know. For example, for the Java language, there's a whole book describing the structure of the Java language in terms of its grammar. You can look up each of the rules that are there and can read a few words of explanation for each of the rules. You can also get yourself books, for example, for the NZC grammar, and look up how C looks like, or even just get yourself some open source compilers or parsers and have a look at their internal grammars, if they have some. A few of the open source projects out there actually have such grammars. A few of them have handcrafted parsers. Depends on the project. You could actually find working grammars for languages that you're interested in. So, anyway, a few more conventions that you have maybe already noticed me using is that there's this operator for alternatives of right-hand sides. So this is just me grouping different right-hand sides for the same left-hand sides of rules into just one right-hand side. You could also write them as separate rules one after the other, and it would still mean the same same thing. So it's just a matter of cleaning up your slides and your grammars, and with that collecting all the right-hand sides that belong to a left-hand side in one place, and then refer to them depending on which of the alternatives which of the alternatives you want to address by talking about their index in this sequence. So you can identify a particular rule that you want to talk about by just talking about the tuple with the left-hand side name and the index of the right-hand side that you want to talk about. So, for example, if we talk about something like STMT2, what we will talk about is this version over here. So this is the same as STMT, goes to REXP. Missed these ones. Okay, so this is just kind of abbreviation of things that we have specified so far. So, languages that you might have already seen in theoretical computer science is, for example, the grammar for arithmetic expressions. You might have seen even several ones for that. So these are typical examples that you find in these kind of lectures. So you do here. So these are the two black boxes here. And, yeah, so this one or this one. Turns out that both of them, for example, describe the same language. We will refer to them a little bit later on. So if you don't remember them, you can look them up here. Also, we introduce kind of the numbering scheme if you refer to a particular right-hand sides for rules. So that's the slide where you can get these things from if you don't remember them by heart. So, yeah, just that you know. So, these now serve as examples for introducing a notion of grammars being term rewriting systems. So, what you can do is do with these rules is that you can rewrite input. So, each of these rewriting steps if you follow the rules from the grammar, it's derivation. And you can do that, for example, for the grammar from before, starting with E for expression. We can then decide to use the rules as a term rewriting system. We're always rewriting non-terminal from a left-hand side of a rule with its according right-hand side. So, in our for our working set right now, we just have this this start symbol E, and we can now start to rewrite with this to following the second grammar from before and to E plus T. What I did was I have rewritten this particular occurrence of a non-terminal, so I have underlined it in this particular example. Here, we have the choice between several non-terminals and in terminal rewriting systems, there's no rule that says us which of them we actually have to rewrite, so we can just arbitrarily select one. Once again, I like to rewrite E's, so I do so. And I might use a different rewriting rule, now rewriting with T. So just this once, because it's still so near to us, For E, we had the choice to rewrite either with this alternative or with this alternative. So I've done so once for variant 0, once for variant 1. So back to this thing. Now I have to continue rewriting, do another derivation, and, well, for example, we can select this T for rewriting. Replace that with right-hand side of our rule set, which would be, for example, T times F. And again, we can rewrite this time. Let's just, for funsies, take the F over here and rewrite that. According to a rule that we have, this F can be rewritten with an integer constant. So this is now a terminal. Terminals can't be rewritten anymore, so this is not a valid choice for rewriting. Instead, we can, for example, choose this T over here and rewrite that into an F, and again, rewrite that into a terminal like this name thing. And now there's only one non-terminal left with which we can do a rewriting, and we go the same chain as before, F and then a terminal, and now we have nothing left anymore. This is now completely rewritten. And this is, in that sense, a sequence of terminals that we could derive from our start symbol. So that is the way that we can use grammars in order to produce sequences of terminals. We can do derivations of our start symbol. So the derivation itself, if you try to formally define what that is you take an occurrence of a non-terminal and replace it with a sequence of non-terminals or terminals if this is defined as a rule in your production set. So far, nothing too complicated. Usually, if we do several of these derivation steps, we then denote them as that and informally talk about the whole chain of derivation steps again as derivation. Okay, of course, one thing is clear in that this derivation relation is nothing general, but it highly depends on what grammars are specified in the context of this relation. So this relation operator, in principle, would have to be annotated with the grammar that this derivation belongs to, but for the purposes of having clean slides, and usually we know which grammar we are referring to, we just drop this parameter from the relation and just put a plain arrow there. We have also seen from the example that we have a certain degree of freedom when doing derivations. Particularly, it's not a predefined where we have to rewrite in our scratch pad thing, and also it's not determined how we will rewrite with respect to which alternative for a particular non-terminal we choose to rewrite. Anyway, what the semantics for such a thing is now is that the language belonging to a particular grammar is all the sequences of terminals that we can derive starting from the start symbol. So, all the rules that we have seen before apply here. So, it doesn't matter where we rewrite, it doesn't matter where we how we rewrite. The collection of all possible things that we can reach by rewriting or deriving with the rules of our grammar are collected in this particular set, and this makes the language that the grammar is specifying. Okay, so in terms of derivations, you will also encounter the term of the particular derivation tree. And what the derivation tree is a kind of a visualization of the steps that we have done in rewriting, in the sense that we start from the start symbol and choose a particular derivation step in terms of alternative of how to rewrite according to the symbol that we rewrite here, and connect this node with the right-hand side as the children of that node. And you see that this incorporates, of course, the terminal symbols, but also the non-terminals of a right-hand side of a rule. And, for example, this part that we see here, this thing here, is the equivalent of the rule E0, which was the same thing as the root node becomes, and then the sequence of its children. So this is E plus T. So this is equivalent to this thing. We now can recursively continue in illustrating what has happened here by once again marking which alternative we choose for that particular non-terminal to derive, and this will, for example, choose the first alternative, which will just derive a T. So it's a singleton sequence on the right-hand side, and this will then derive this T times F, while this T, for example, is deriving F, and in the end deriving name, for example. So it's a graphical way of illustrating how the derivation from the start tree to the sequence of terminals actually looks like. And you see that in a completely derived derivation tree, when we can derive nothing more, every leaf of the derivation tree is now a terminal, cannot be further derived, and if you put them in the order in which you find them from left to right in the thing, you call this thing the yield of a derivation tree, or of a derivation. So if we talk about derivations, there's also a few subclasses of derivations which we talk about, namely the ones that follow particular patterns of where, so the positions of where to rewrite, in the sense that there is the notion of leftmost derivations and rightmost derivations. So this means that each of the there's a fixed strategy which non-terminal to derive next, and for those you will see these indices uppercase L or R used frequently later on. So this refers to leftmost and rightmost derivations usually, and these derivations usually can be reconstructed by if you have the derivation tree, by doing a depth first search through this derivation tree, and doing so in pre-order. So each time that that you are about to descend into a subtree, you will yield the derivation index of the alternative that you have chosen for derivation for that particular subtree, and that gives you the sequence of derivations that you have followed for this particular derivation tree. And this is important because a few of these special derivations correspond to particular ideas of how to perform parsing later on. So that's why I'm so eager to tell you about those. So there's, for example, the leftmost derivations for a given syntax tree. For example, this one here, a leftmost derivation would consist in a depth-first search pre-order, giving you e0, starting from the root, then going to the first child is e1, then t0, so this is e1, e0, e1, t0, t1, f1, and name is not, in that sense, a valuable derivation anymore, so we backtrack to wherever our next unvisited thing is, which is this f2. We continue with this one. We backtrack to this one here, going to t1, and then to f2, and are done with this leftmost derivation. Same as that, we can also do a rightmost derivation, once again starting with a root, like this one, then going to the right for rightmost. So this yields t1, f2, e1, t0, rightmost goes to here, so f2, then t1, f1, like this. So this is a rightmost derivation. And then there's an even more strange thing, the so-called reverse rightmost derivation, which is two things. For once, it is just the string reversal of the rightmost derivation. But in more practical terms, what it is it is kind of a bottom-up run through the whole thing, starting with f1, t1, f2. Now that both children are available, we yield this t0, we yield e1. We would like to yield e0, but the other part is not yet visited, so this is f2, then t1, and then e0. So this is the rightmost derivation. This corresponds to a move from bottom up through this derivation tree. And yeah, the yield we have already talked about. This is just the concatenation of all the leaves in the direction from left to right. A notion of unique grammars should be mentioned, because that might occur also in the following slides. So unique grammars are grammars for which you only find one particular derivation tree at most in your language that actually has one particular yield. So for each yield there's only one derivation that you can do with that particular grammar. If you this property doesn't hold, then your grammar is not unique anymore. There are several ways of constructing derivations to reach a particular yield, then you have ambiguous grammars. And of course you would like to have unique grammars in order to define actually the meaning of a particular language. So this is all that you need about these hierarchical terms and grammars. You have seen that these leftmost derivations are used for this top-down reconstruction of a syntax tree. This reverse rightmost derivations contributes to a view of bottom-up reconstruction of a syntax tree, and both of them we will use to construct particular automata for parsing. And I think with that we will continue next time. Good luck in the tutorial, and see you next week.